Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so thank you so much, Jean-François, for the very kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be at the prestigious Collège de France on this prestigious day to tell you a little bit about the science we do. And so we will keep going on developmental timing and human brain evolution. So I think my immediate predecessor did a great job, actually, to try to explain to you that this is an interesting topic. But I will take a very different perspective. I would say more reductionist in a way, and more cellular and molecular. But maybe at the end, hopefully, you'll see that there are very interesting points of convergence. So in my lab, we're interested mostly in two things and try to link these two problems. On the one hand, the mechanisms of development of the cerebral cortex, and on the other hand, what underlies the evolution of development of the human brain, and thereby the evolution of the human brain. And the reason why we focus on the cortex is because the cortex is arguably the most complex, but also one of the most divergent structures in our brain compared with all other mammals, and even compared with our closest, not yet extinct cousins, such as the chimpanzee. The human cortex displays increased size and complexity, meaning essentially increased number of neuronal and glial cells, but also a potentially different type of different composition of these cell types. It also displays a number of, my mouse, so I'll have to do it this way, and I apologize for those who will look at the movie. So there are distinctive also features at the circuit level, as well as the neuronal level. So human neurons display a number of interesting specialization, including in their basic so-called intrinsic electrophysiological properties, and also in the way neurons are connected with one another within the cortex. And collectively, these global and cellular level features have a number of differences, have a number of consequences, And one of them, probably, that we are also interested in is potential, let's say, species-specific disease sensitivity. In other words, that diseases such as schizophrenia or Alzheimer's disease that seem to particularly strike the human species and not so much other species may somehow be touching on the very mechanisms that, at the more molecular or cellular level, drive those human specialization. And so the specialization that I want to focus on today, obviously, is another one that I think was already beautifully introduced, and that is the prolonged development of the human brain, and in particular, actually, of the human cerebral cortex. Now, I'm going to take a look at it at a more cellular level, and also a developmental level, let's say, than what you heard before. So the time scale of human cerebral cortex development is extended, but it's not extended homogeneously, and also the development of the cortex actually corresponds to a variety of molecular and cellular processes. So the first process that is extended in time is the so-called cortical neurogenesis, or generated of cortical neurons, whereby neural stem cells will actually generate it sequentially the neurons that will populate the six layers of the cortex. And this process, which follows a very defined sequence that's completely conserved among all mammals, is actually considerably extended in time in human, where it takes more than 3 months, while only 1 week in the mouse. And non-human primates like the macaque would be in between at around 3 weeks of neurogenesis. So this extension of neurogenesis is thought to be a first interesting feature of human cortical development. The second one is that once neurons are generated, they become postmitotic, they don't divide anymore, but they will undergo considerable changes morphologically, transcriptomically, and physiologically to become neurons that are mature and function in a given circuit. And I show you here this very dramatic result of Petanjek and colleagues, where you see those structures here, which are dendrites of the neurons, and their spines, which are used here as a proxy of the synapses of these neurons, and how they basically take up to 15 years to reach a plateau of generation in the human species, while the equivalent in the mouse would take about 2 to 3 weeks. So that suggests, again, a prolonged maturation of cortical neuron, and even larger, I would say, in terms of extension of time scale. And I would add that what I just showed you about neurogenesis and neuronal maturation is also true, actually, for generation of glial cells, as well as the important process of myelination. That's probably the one that is most protracted in time in human compared with non-human species. And again, here I use the mouse as an extreme, but a number of other species on which we have some ground truth, such as macaque or ferret or cat, go in line with this very extended time scale in the human species. Now, obviously, I don't need to tell you that. I don't need to tell that to this audience. If you think about evolution, you have to think about consequences of these processes at the level of fitness, so to speak. So what is it good for, if it's good for anything? And so as far as prolonged cortical neurogenesis, well, it is thought that increased number and increased repertoire of specific types of neurons may actually underlie some of the features of cortical circuits that do indeed need more neurons, for instance, to have more cortico-cortical synapses. And on the other hand, when it comes to cortical development, well, there's this classical hypothesis that the fact that cortical neurons take a long time to become mature in a functional circuit leads to a form of neoteny, so a retention of juvenile properties of cortical neurons and circuit that may underlie, for instance, extended period of what I would call experience-dependent plasticity, which can be then underlie some of the higher or, let's say, specialized cognitive and social features that characterize our species. But I think it's important to know that this remains, I would say, in my view, largely speculative, because we don't know actually what are the consequences of prolonged developmental timing on the function of neural circuits. And so what I'm going to try to discuss with you today now is how, at the mechanistic level, one can understand that similar choreography can take place with a different tempo. And I would argue that there's probably not a single clock or a single tempo master, but many of them, fortunately and unfortunately here, I would say, for those dancers who have to follow this single old guy. There are actually several mechanisms, and I'll tell you about two main mechanisms today that we think underlie some of the species-specific tempo of human cortical development. And I will touch upon, if I have time, on what we can try to do using our knowledge on these mechanisms to start, barely I would say, to understand what could be the consequences of cortical neoteny on brain function as well as disease. Okay, so the way we got interested into this question is actually performing experiments that were not really aimed at studying neoteny, but turns out that they really were very informative in that respect. So the experiment is the following. We start from pluripotent stem cells derived from various species. We can make them into immature cortical pyramidal neurons, so the neurons that normally display this neoteny in human, but not in mouse, for instance. And we can transplant these neurons in the mouse and then look at their final development or their development in the mouse brain. And at first, our main goal was basically a sort of quality check to see whether these neurons that are completely artificial, generated from stem cells, were able to function in a cortical circuit. And in fact, they are. But what's important here is that here's just a picture of how human neurons look like embedded in a cortical gray matter. But what's important here is that mouse-to-mouse transplantation enabled the transplanted mouse neurons to develop in 1 to 2 months. So along a timeline that's very similar to the host mouse neuron, to the in vivo timeline, physiological timeline of mouse corticogenesis, while the human-to-mouse transplantation is actually very much prolonged in time. And basically, you see that it takes up to 18 months to reach a level of maturity of the dendritic spines for these neurons. And in fact, even there, we're probably not yet mature. So this, together with data obtained actually from other labs, also using great ape-derived pluripotent stem cells, suggests that the cells basically that are transplanted follow the timeline of origin of their brain and not the timeline of the host, so suggesting that there's a largely cell intrinsic component of whatever controls the developmental timing of the cortical neurons. So at least we knew then where to look at, so to speak. The mechanism must be somehow within the neurons or within part of the neuron. So when you think of evolution of development, it's typical to think of developmental gene regulatory networks, that an ensemble of genes, the interactions of which would lead to a particular result in organogenesis, and that takes a certain time. And you can think that changes in the regulation, such as timing or quantity of expression of particular genes, may lead to different timing or heterochrony. And there are examples like this throughout the literature of developmental and evolutionary biology. But when it comes to human brain development, no such example exists yet, and in particular because the regulatory elements that we look at and compare between human and mouse, for instance, are extremely similar, so similar that so far it's really a needle in the haystack to find regulatory changes that may explain differences in timing. So for that reason, a number of years ago, we made this hypothesis that maybe it's things outside of the gene regulatory network of neuronal development itself, global cellular processes in particular, that could somehow drive the speed of development, but in a way that does not depend on the precise developmental gene regulation per se. And in particular, what we did is to focus on the very simplistic hypothesis, I must say, that mitochondria and metabolism may be a rate-limiting step in the growth of neurons that could be different in species, perhaps, and thereby explain how is it that neurons grow slower in one species than another. And the work I'm going to summarize for you now was performed by two amazing postdoc and student in the lab, Ryo Iwata and Pierre Casimir. So what they developed first is a system, I'm not going to go into the details here, but to genetically label either human or mouse cortical neurons, either in vitro or in vivo, so that we can actually date the neuron. We know when they are born as a postmitotic cell. And then we can look at how the cells grow and how their mitochondria look like. And we came with this result that actually was a surprise, even though there was bits about it in the literature, that newborn neurons have very few mitochondria that are very fragmented, as you can see. And as neurons develop, they have more and more of these mitochondria in green that are more and more complex and more mature-like. This is the process as it takes place in the mouse, and you can see this nice grow in the morphology of the mitochondria that sort of follow the development of neuron, or maybe precedes it. When you look now at human neurons, well, it's the same picture, so to speak. Fewer mitochondria to start with, getting larger and more numerous over time, but the time scale of development is considerably protracted, so that it takes now weeks and weeks, actually months, in vivo to get to the final pattern of maturation of mitochondria. So there's a striking correlation between the dynamics of mitochondria and the development of neurons. Also at the level of metabolism, there are species differences and developmental dynamics. So if we look now at oxygen consumption as a proxy of mitochondria function in the neurons, well, we see that in the mouse, it starts with low levels and increases very rapidly in about 3 weeks, while in the human, you see that it increases as well, but following the protracted timeline that is similar to what I showed you in terms of morphology. So everything is as if the human cortical neurons at similar time points are basically using much less of mitochondria metabolism. They are in a sort of state, and we confirm this using glucose metabolic labeling, in a state of aerobic glycolysis. They basically use glucose or other metabolites without burning them with oxygen. So with that, we then started to go beyond and ask whether this was just a correlation between mitochondria metabolism and neuronal development, or whether there was any causality. And in particular, what we did is a number of experiments that I'm going to summarize you, where we genetically or pharmacologically manipulated human or mouse neurons and asked whether we can change their rate of maturation. And what I will show you is basically the data that indicate that enhanced mitochondria metabolism in human neurons can accelerate their maturation. So we used a number of manipulations. I'm not going to go into the details here, but it all goes down to increasing the ability of the mitochondria in a given cell to use either glucose or fatty acid towards oxidative phosphorylation through the Krebs cycle. and using basically tricks that have been used in oncology to basically get rid of the so-called Warburg effect in growing cancer cells. But now applying it to neurons, the striking result that we got is that we can indeed accelerate. Here you can see the dendritic growth of the human neurons treated in this treatment that basically increased both glucose and fatty acid consumption by mitochondria. You can see also that their complexity is increased. And again, just an example of many data, their physiological properties are also changed more rapidly over time so that they make more synapses or faster. They make faster synapses over time, and individual synapses actually also become more mature over time. So a global acceleration of neuronal maturation that we observe. So to summarize what I showed you, neurons develop over time mitochondria along a different timeline in human and mouse, and this seems to have a causal relationship because enhancing mitochondria metabolism accelerates neuronal development. And conversely, I don't have time to show you the data, but decreasing mitochondria metabolism in mouse neurons will decrease the rate at which they can grow dendrites, at which they can become mature neurons. Now, what I'd like to do now is basically on this aspect of global metabolism that could be, setting the scale of neuronal development. I want to discuss two other topics for which we have ongoing results that are still unpublished that I want to share with you. On the one hand, is this model somehow unique to cortical neurons, or can it be applied to other temporal patterns of development? And on the other hand, how does mitochondria metabolism actually regulate developmental tempo in this context? And again, we start to have some interesting hints that I will share with you. And this is the work, again, of Ryo Iwata, but this time together with two other PhD students, Emir Erkol and Isabel Gallego, and senior staff scientist Rida Limam. And the other model now that I want to discuss is actually the very first one that I started with, the cortical neurogenesis that is considerably extended in time from mouse to human. But this is quite a different cellular process where stem cells change of competence over time to generate different types of neurons, and when they have 3 months to develop, obviously, they can make more neurons than when they only have 1 week. But how does that work? How this superconserved sequence is extended in time scale remains very mysterious in the field. And so we thought, given our data, that maybe mitochondria could be involved. And the reason why we thought that mitochondria could be equally involved, so to speak, is because also in vitro settings or transplantation, this timeline of generation of neurons from cortical stem cells is highly conserved, so that this protracted time is also observed if you take human cortical progenitors and put them in culture, compared with mouse cortical progenitors put in culture. So is mitochondria metabolism involved? So the first important type of experiments that we did is to focus now on the stem cells of the cortex, the progenitors that we sorted in a variety of ways. And I'm going to just show you the data that we obtained with mitochondria oxygen consumption. The result that we got is actually quite striking. The mouse cortical progenitors at all stages of corticogenesis display much higher levels of mitochondria oxidative phosphorylation activity than human, whether derived from, in this case, cortical organoids, so stem cell models, or from human fetal cortex, prepared in the same way as the mouse embryonic cortex. And when we look then in more detail into what aspect of mitochondria oxidative activity is particularly enhanced, so to speak, in the mouse versus the human, or lower in the human compared with the mouse, well, to make a long story short, we found that it's the ability to oxidate fatty acid, which happens in the mitochondria. It's the so-called fatty acid oxidation, or FAO, that seems to be dramatically different in levels between mouse and human. So with this in hand, we decided then to test whether cortical neurogenesis and this temporal patterning of generation of the various types of neurons in the cortex can be somehow regulated by free fatty acid. And again, I'm going to summarize here quite a lot of data, but we use in this case another in vitro model of cortical organoids, where basically, as you can see here, we can recapitulate the fact that neurons of different identity are generated at different time points. You see here early born neurons in pink expressing CTYP2 and late neurons in green expressing SATB2. So that's what is the temporal pattern that is remarkably conserved in vitro, in vivo, and in any given species, except for the time scale. And now that's the result if we treat the cortical organoids just with an increased concentration of free fatty acid as a substrate for fatty acid oxidation. So you see basically this 3 to 6 week reduction of the time scale of cortical temporal patterning, so that everything is accelerated using these treatments. And the same is true for many other markers that we looked at, of course. And looking then at what could be, let's say, the underlying mechanism, we looked at a more global level at the cortical organoids, with and without the free fatty acid, but using now single nucleus RNA sequencing, so looking at the whole or at least a good fraction of the transcriptome of all the cells of the organoids in both conditions. And to make a long story short, we confirmed that those neurons that are born late are appearing too early, so acceleration. But also, and that's the important result, we saw an acceleration in the patterns of gene expression of the neural stem cells, the radial glia, that basically look more similar to later stages when they are treated with free fatty acid. So their transcriptome profile change in time is accelerated. And same is true with neuronal maturation. So in a way, there are global transcriptional changes that accompany the treatments of free fatty acid on the cortical cells, whether stem cells or neurons. So what could be then behind this? So we followed this hypothesis that actually comes from the field of cancer biology again, and also adult stem cells, that mitochondria are actually a source of very interesting metabolites, not linked to ATP per se, not linked to energy per se, but that are either modulators or actually, when it comes to acetyl-CoA, direct substrate of post-translational modifications of many proteins. And in particular, this has been looked at a lot with histones. Histones, which, as you know, are associated with gene regulation, in particular when it comes to their post-translational modification. So could it be that this is what happens in this case? Well, turns out probably at least in part. So we followed this model here that is not ours, that was actually demonstrated, for instance, in muscle development, in vitro in other settings, where free fatty acid, which is a very good source of acetyl-CoA, will then rise to citrate through the Krebs cycle, which is then exported to the cytoplasm or the nucleus, which is then converted by this enzyme ACLY to become acetyl-CoA that then can, if increased in concentration, lead to enhanced histone acetylation and potentially then changes in transcriptional regulation and cell fate transition. And basically, I'll just show you two data that fit with this model in our system. On the one hand, the levels of acetyl-CoA are increased when we treat the cortical organoids with free fatty acid. So there is a first link here that seems to be correct, also in corticogenesis. And also, and most importantly, I think, there's a dramatic change in the pattern of acetylation of many proteins. And I just show here H4K16, a classical marker of transcriptional upregulation that is strongly upregulated following the free fatty acid treatment, and also importantly, completely blocked with this drug that blocks the conversion of citrate into acetyl-CoA outside the mitochondria. So to make a long story short, we find basically that there are changes in the metabolism of radial glial cells, just like in neurons, that seem to participate to prolonged timing of neurogenesis. But in this case, we have evidence that the link may well be through acetyl-CoA and perhaps other metabolites coming from the mitochondria. Now, with the remaining time, I would like to discuss another type of mechanism and emphasize that, obviously, mitochondrial metabolism is just one of many different clocks that regulate developmental timing. And I want to show you now, very quickly, some data that have been published over the years by our group and the group of Franck Poleu and Cécile Charrier on species-specific gene regulation that can impact developmental timing. So what I mean by that is that even though a given gene regulatory network may be almost the same across species, there may be additional gene in a particular species that may then have as a main consequence the change of progression of development, the fate of the speed of progression of development. So how are these genes emerging? Well, it's mostly the work of Evan Eichler and colleagues that have shown that these genes can be duplicated through a sort of copy-paste mechanism, and then in the human lineage in particular, hundreds of such gene copy duplicates have been identified. And Ikuo Suzuki, when he was a postdoc in the lab, identified that dozens of them actually encode coding transcripts that are heavily and actively and dynamically expressed in the human cortex. And I'm going to focus on one such gene called SRGAP2. That was originally identified by Franck Peleu and Cécile Charrier. What they identified is that SRGAP2 is an ancestral protein that actually promotes synapse formation, and it was duplicated in the human lineage several times, leading to human-specific genes that are actually thought to act essentially as inhibitors of the ancestral protein, so that overexpressing the human-specific gene in the mouse leads to delayed maturation. So this relatively simple model, and I'm going to go relatively quickly here, but we could find, and in particular together with Baptiste Libé-Philippot, a postdoc in the lab, who now has his own lab in Marseille, that this is also true in human neurons. And basically what he could find is that when now reducing the level of the human-specific gene, we can dramatically accelerate the rate of maturation of the human neurons. They're accelerated 12 months ahead of time by removing these human-specific genes. So that's another clock, so to speak, but this case with a human-specific gene. And I'm going to take one more minute or two to go to the question of circuit function, fitness, and disease. And thanks to this opportunity that we found in the lab through various ways that I don't have time to show you, that this pathway that is regulated in a human-specific fashion acts actually, among others, through this very important protein called SYNGAP1. And SYNGAP1 is a synaptic protein that happens to be encoded by a gene that is mutated in various cases of intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder. It's actually one of the most frequently mutating genes in these conditions. So we thought, can we then have a first indication of a link between neural circuit function and neoteny, since SYNGAP1 mutant neurons are also accelerated? So the neurons that display mutations that are found in those patients affected by ID and ASD. And the way we looked at this, and we'll end up with this, and the question of plasticity that we heard also quite a bit today, the idea here is that maybe it is the plasticity of neural circuits in response to the environment that has to be extended in time to allow specialized cognitive and social features, and this is what is modulated by synaptic neoteny. So you know the classical view of the ocular dominance plasticity, where the two eyes compete basically for cortical territory, and if one of the two eyes is closed, this territory will innervated corresponding to this will be shrunk, while the other one will win territory, so to speak. This is the classical model of Hubel and Wiesel that show basically at the anatomical level and functional level what plasticity is about in the cortex. And so with Vincent Bonin, our neighbor at NERF, and Ben Vermaak, that scientist in the lab, we tested whether that plasticity is modulated in context where synaptic neoteny is changed. And for that, we use functional imaging of, and I'm going a bit quick here, but it's actually quite cool, human neurons that are transplanted in the mouse visual cortex, and we can record their activity in response to visual stimulation. And we can do that before or after monocular deprivation and ask, are they able to respond to a change in the environment and in the experience of the animal, but at the level of the human cortical neurons. And what we show, what we find actually, even though this is in mouse that are 6 months old, so adult, they actually remarkably show this plasticity. So the human neurons in a 6-month-old adult mouse displays juvenile properties. And these juvenile properties, this is work in progress, but the current data suggest that this plasticity is actually strongly impaired when we remove the SYNGAP1 gene that, as I told you, was required for the synaptic neoteny. So, of course, there's still a lot of ifs, but this is to us a first way to try to address experimentally what is the meaning of developmental timing for cortical circuit function and development, and ultimately human brain evolution. So with that, I will stop And I think, I hope, I thought, I thank all the critical people who've been involved in this work. Thank you, and sorry for being a bit over time.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.